and Foundation. Today's program was prepared by Eric Sonstrom with help from Ben Brabson in physics. For A Moment of Science, I'm Yael Cassander.
WILA programs are made possible by the Beckman Institute, whose Thursdays at 12:20 concert series features performances by members of the University of Illinois School of Music in the Beckman Institute atrium. The Beckman Institute Cafe is open for lunch during the concerts.
It's 2:40. In sports, Joe Maddon has won the American League Manager of the Year after guiding the Tampa Bay Rays from baseball's basement to the World Series. Lou Piniella of the Chicago Cubs is the National League winner. Maddon succeeded Piniella as Tampa Bay manager in 2006. He was an easy winner in balloting by the Baseball Writers Association of America. Piniella led the NL Central champion Cubs to the league's best record, leading him to his third Manager of the Year award and first in the NL. In college football action tonight, Northern Illinois and Central Michigan will face off in DeKalb. It'll be the 44th meeting between the two teams dating back to 1939. The St. Louis Blues haven't won a game since beating Florida 4-0 on October 25th. Because of that drought, the Blues bring a 5-7-1 record into tonight's game in Buffalo. The Sabres, meanwhile, will be trying to break out of their own funk. They haven't beaten St. Louis and Buffalo in more than 13 years. And the Chicago Blackhawks are 6-0-2 at the United Center this year, heading into tonight's home game against the Boston Bruins. The Bruins have won the last two meetings with the Hawks, including a 5-3 victory in December of 2006 in their last visit to Chicago. That's sports.
Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from Trophy Time in Champaign. With plaques and promotional products to recognize all occasions from athletic endeavors and musical moments to business achievements. Trophy Time, they're more than just trophies. Additional information available on the web at trophytime.com.
It's 2:42. The cow hormone known as RBST or RBGH has taken a beating in the environmental community. Injecting the hormone into cows makes them produce more milk. But some people are afraid the hormone can find its way from the cow to the cow's milk and into our bodies. The government insists that is not the case. Sean Ali says one researcher wants to change the debate about RBST and convince environmentalists to support the hormone.
Before I introduce you to the researcher who supports RBST or RBGH, I want you to understand what she's up against. It's well-meaning people like Steve Parks. Parks co-owns New Leaf Natural Food Store in Chicago. He decides what's on the shelves.
A lot goes into making that decision. I think first and foremost is it something I would eat myself?
And as for milk produced with RBGH, Parks will not sell it.
People have been drinking milk for thousands of years from animals that didn't have RBGH in them. So I think I'm a little more comfortable drinking milk from a cow that did not have RBGH than I am from something that is a very, very new technology.
A lot of people distrust RBGH, and that's changed the milk market. For example, some retailers like Starbucks will not buy milk from dairies that use it. In fact, more and more dairies are asking farmers to pledge not to use the hormone. The trend frustrates researcher Judith Kapper.
People aren't questioning the science basis of it.
Kapper is with Cornell University. She argues environmentalists and consumers should take another look at the hormone and see it as part of the solution to global warming. Kapper recently co-wrote a study that began with a simple observation. In a few decades, there will be many more Americans.
U.S. population will have gone up from about 300 million people to 377 million people. And we wanted to look at the environmental impact of producing enough milk to feed all of those people.
That scares Kapper, because producing milk can make the global warming problem worse. That's because feeding cows, and in some sense the cows themselves, lead to more greenhouse gas emissions.
Okay, so we have about six major inputs and outputs in terms of carbon.
I won't go through all six, but here are a few. First, there's the feed that cows eat. Tractors have to plant grain. That burns fossil fuels. You get greenhouse gases. Then feed is trucked to the dairy farm. More greenhouse gases. More cows, more greenhouse gases. So you want as much milk as possible from each cow.
If you give RBST to a cow, it will produce an extra 10 pounds of milk per day. That's quite an increase.
And then there's the other greenhouse gases from, well, let's just say it's the ugly end of the cow equation. Cow manure puts off potent greenhouse gases, and cows belch methane. Cows that use RBST poop and belch less, and that spares the atmosphere even more carbon. All this leads Capper to a startling conclusion. She says if farmers gave 1 million cows the hormone,
using RBST would be like taking about 400,000 cars off the road or planting about 300 million trees. You know, that's a really massive impact. Those are really big numbers.
Judith Capper says she expects scientists will challenge her research, and she welcomes a good debate about RBGH and RBST. She says that's better than this vague idea that the hormone might somehow be bad without understanding the whole story.
Choose organic, choose RBST-free, but base it on facts and science, not on consumer perceptions that may not be factually correct.
But Capper has her work cut out for her. Government statistics show consumer fear about RBGH has made farmers cut the percentage of cows injected with the hormone. For the Environment Report, I'm Sean Ali.
Next, NPR's national political correspondent, Mara Liasson, has a report on Barack Obama's grassroots supporters, those millions of volunteers and small donors who helped him beat John McCain. Can they help the president-elect govern?
On election night, a victorious Barack Obama thanked his wife and his campaign manager and his strategist, but then he thanked his volunteers, the army of political foot soldiers who donated money and knocked on doors.
This is your victory. Now, I know you didn't do this just to win an election. I know you didn't do it for me.
Now the incoming president has to be just as innovative in harnessing their power post-election as he was during the campaign. Howard Dean is the outgoing chairman of the DNC, and he's thrilled Obama has brought millions of new people into the Democratic Party.
He's changed all the rules, not just with the use of the internet and the fundraising, but he's changed the rules in terms of how you ask people for their vote and who you ask for your vote.
Obama took the foundation Dean himself dug in 2004 with his small-dollar internet fundraising and at the DNC with his now-vindicated 50-state strategy. And on top of all that, Obama erected a powerful political infrastructure. The numbers are eye-popping. 10 million names on an email list, 3.1 million donors. But the most important number of all may be the tens of thousands of what the campaign called super volunteers, people who worked sometimes 40 or 50 hours a week for Obama.
We've run sort of a giant experiment here in volunteer management, and we want to take a look at the lessons learned from that.
John Carson was the national field director for the Obama campaign, and he's one of the people trying to figure out what to do with the grassroots movement Obama created.
As President-elect Obama takes office and a legislative agenda is put together, I think in the same way that these incredible volunteers that we had carried his message throughout the campaign, talking to their neighbors about why he was the right candidate to bring the change that we needed, I can see them in a similar way explaining a health care proposal, explaining whatever issue it is.
And, of course, as soon as they're done explaining Obama's plans to their neighbors, President Obama can go right around the so-called media filter and urge them, through text messages and emails and video links, to inundate their Congress members with expressions of support for his agenda.
My name's Tony Lloyd, and I live in Racine, Wisconsin.
Meet one member of Obama's grassroots movement. Tony Lloyd used to live in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, where he first saw Obama and volunteered. Then his job took him to Wisconsin.
I went online again to, you know, sort of click the little volunteer button, and I went down to the local Barack Obama campaign headquarters and walked in and said, "What do you need me to do?"
Lloyd became an Obama team leader, getting out the vote. Since last Tuesday, he's remained plugged in to mybarackobama.com. And on Monday night, Lloyd himself created a new website, yeswecanracine.com. By Tuesday morning, it had 12 members.
There is an entire army out here who is anxious to continue to push in the same direction. And whatever he asks us to do, we will do. If he needs me to call my member of Congress, you know, I'm perfectly willing to do that. And the beauty of the web-enabled infrastructure that he built is the fact that it gives us all a way to be part of the conversation, both uploading our ideas and downloading from the Obama administration.
Lloyd's already been to the Obama transition website, change.gov. In keeping with the campaign's interactive approach, it asks visitors to share their memories of election night and their ideas for Obama's agenda. It's a way for the new administration to keep its supporters engaged until it knows what else it wants them to do. So if Howard Dean, with his millions of small donors, was Orville Wright, and Obama, with his wired grassroots, was Neil Armstrong, what will be next? Sarah Taylor is the former political director of the Bush White House, and she has one idea.
We're at a place in the country where almost everybody has a cell phone, but not many people have a smartphone, meaning a video-enabled phone. That'll change over the next 3 to 4 or 5 years.
And by then, Taylor says, if you're a mom with two kids who cares about education,
a smart, forward-leaning campaign will know that. They will have had you sign up into their system, and they'll be able to serve you advertising via a text message that links right to a video with your candidate speaking in a beautiful video about the importance of education reform. That, I think, is most likely to be sort of the next iteration of new technology.
It's a lot cheaper than buying television ad time, and it's just technology, available to any political party so long as it can harness it to serve a powerful message and a messenger, just like Barack Obama did. Mara Liasson, NPR News, Washington.
Commentator Paula Poundstone supported Barack Obama. She says she's ready for a new assignment.
People still seem full of hope after the historic election of Barack Obama. This is America, though. It can't last. Pleased and proud as we are, Obama hasn't been on American Idol, so we're bound to lose interest soon. That's why President-elect Obama needs to waste no time in harnessing this feeling and ask something of us. We'll spend. We'll save. We'll do laps. We'll wear sweaters. My parents are a part of the greatest generation. They pulled our nation through the Depression and World War II, and when they heard the call, they collected rubber. My generation rode out the Beanie Baby crash, ran up both credit card debt and the nation's weight, and brought us reality TV and the SUV. But it's not all we can do. We've grown up collecting box tops and shoes. We've earned free donuts by getting our cards punched with every dozen purchased. We're the a-thon generation. We've jogged, walked, and pedaled thousands of miles because someone said it would cure cancer. It's our turn now. Just ask us. We've adopted freeways and been up all night with night feedings. We'll bring an unwrapped gift. We'll bring canned goods. We'll collect flip-tops. Yes, we will. What do you need us to do, President-elect Obama? We could form a bucket brigade to bail out the banks. We could collect Band-Aids, not the useless little ones, for the healthcare system. We could take shifts forming human pyramids to hold up our crumbling bridges. The entire country could hold a progressive dinner party to feed the homeless. We could all commit to wearing the same clothes 2 days in a row to save water, energy, and time. I'll go three because I care more than the others. We can carry road mending materials in our cars and fill potholes during traffic jams. We can put a wishing well on Wall Street. Our leadership has told us that we have a long, hard climb before us, which I would welcome because I love the outdoors and I could use the weight loss. But I have a bad feeling it has nothing to do with climbing. I'm waiting. I'm punching my glove. It's oiled and ready. Pitch it in here, sir.
Commentator Paula Poundstone. A new administration means new White House employees and with them FBI background checks for security clearances. Commentator Amy Guida explains how deep investigators will go in this week's edition of Legal Issues in the News.
My husband worked for a time in Laurel, Maryland, just outside of Washington, D.C., fairly close to the National Security Agency. NSA describes itself as the group that coordinates, directs, and performs highly specialized activities to protect U.S. government information systems and to produce foreign signals intelligence information. It would be inadvisable to ask follow-up questions. Being so close to NSA, my husband received a phone call one evening regarding the upstairs neighbor. Did he know the guy? Had he heard or seen anything unusual coming from that apartment? Was there any reason that the neighbor shouldn't be given access to top national security information? My husband didn't know any dirt, so the proxy for NSA went on his merry investigative way. I was reminded of that story when I read that the FBI has been looking into President-elect Obama's staffers and whether they can be trusted with state secrets. It's nothing unusual. With White House transitions come FBI background checks. But we're not talking here about a quick call to a reference. According to the FBI website, the General Security Clearance Form asks applicants to go way back, for some from age 18 on, and answer the following questions. Where have you lived? Where did you go to school? What employment have you had? Who knows you best? When have you traveled abroad and why and what did you do there? What is your medical history, your employment record, your police record, your use of illegal drugs and alcohol, your finances, your financial delinquencies, and your civil court actions? As the security level moves up from secret to top secret, the investigation deepens. According to some court cases, ones that generally hold that investigators have the final say on security clearances because courts don't want to second-guess those experts expert enough to, quote, predict the future behavior of the applicant, the investigators don't necessarily trust the applicant's answers. Here's the follow-up that applicants agree to, one court explained, that investigators have permission to obtain any information relating to the applicant's activities from individuals, schools, residential management agents, employers, credit bureaus, consumer reporting agencies, collection agencies, retail business establishments, or other sources of information. The Laurel call to my husband proves how deep they'll dig. He was connected to the applicant only by a shared ceiling/floor. Moreover, statutory language suggests that unfavorable or questionable information about the applicant will require what is intriguingly called select scoping. Once that scoping is complete and the applicant is approved, she or he will be forced to sign a non-disclosure agreement so that state secrets stay secret. Some quasi-government workers have fought back. Take employees at the California Institute of Technology's Jet Propulsion Laboratory who worked with NASA. NASA required that every one of them submit to in-depth background investigations. But the workers argued that they were Caltech employees, not NASA employees, and shouldn't be forced to give investigators free rein to ask other sources of information about their finances, honesty, and the seriously open-ended other matters. Just last June, a federal appellate court in California agreed that such an investigation raised serious privacy issues. But those accustomed to politics on President-elect Obama's White House list are also more likely accustomed to FBI investigations. In fact, if they've lived for a time in the nation's capital, they too may have received a call in the night from a stranger asking about the guy upstairs. I'm Amy Guida.
Earth and Sky.
Wednesday, November 12, 2008. It's sometimes said that the full moon stays up all night and sleeps in all day.
That's exactly what the November